Hello and welcome to I'm All Over the Place with Dara Starr Tucker. I am she, and I am so glad to be back with you again this week, presenting an episode to you that I have done for KJLH, the radio station that I am now working for in the LA area. I'll let the KJLH version of me explain to you what the episode's going to be about. But for those of you who are my podcast listeners, if you are watching the video version of this on YouTube, then you probably recognize that there is a little bit of a different background behind me. I am in a cabin in the woods in Arkansas. I just finished a performance at the University of Arkansas. I am headed to Tulsa now to do a performance there. And on the 17th of March, I will be performing for a series called Jazz on the Move in Nashville, Tennessee. That is being put on through the Nashville Jazz Workshop. I'll be doing a tribute show to one of my favorite singers, Miss Nancy Wilson. That is a first-come, first-served show, so you just kind of show up at the Frist on the 17th of March. I think the show happens somewhere around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and people start lining up well before that, not because of me, but because that series is so very popular. I've done shows on Nina Simone and Betty Carter in the past. I've actually done a show on Nancy Wilson in the past, and they are requesting that I do that again this year. So I'm really excited to be presenting that later this month. So I'll be out on the road for at least the first half of March doing various shows. And of course, on the 22nd, as I've told you all, I will be at Blues Alley in DC. I definitely would love for you to get online and get your tickets to the Blues Alley show. That's a Friday night, March 22nd. Two shows, one at 7 and one at 9 o'clock. If you're going to be anywhere near DC, I would love to see you at the Blues Alley show. You can get your tickets now. It looks like we will be in Philadelphia in July. I'll have more information on that show for you coming up, and another show that we will possibly be doing in May in an undisclosed location that has yet to be announced. Stay tuned for that. But I want to remind you all, the I'm All Over the Place audience, to please rate and review the show on whatever podcasting platform you use. It really helps us in the rankings. Spread the word, tell people about the show. And of course, I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/Dara Starr Tucker. If you are not a patron yet, that is one way that you can substantially and materially support the work that I do. I'm so appreciative to all of you for being here, and I hope that you are enjoying these episodes from my KJLH show. I'm so glad to be able to share them with you. Without further ado, the next episode of The Breakdown. Here it is. Well, hi there, folks. My name is Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. I'm so happy to be back with you again this week to have important conversations about the issues that matter. You know what I'm getting ready to ask you right now, don't you? Do you have the KJLH app? If you are not listening to us on the KJLH app, you are missing out on the full potential of the experience that you could be having with the music that you love, with the talk that you love. You can take us with you wherever you go. You don't have to wait till you get in your car. You don't have to wait till you get to your office. You can listen to KJLH anywhere. At the gym, you can listen to us when you're taking your walks. Listen to us when you're on vacation. We can literally be with you anywhere you go. Download the KJLH app at the App Store. If you're on iPhone, if you're on Android, it's available on both platforms. You can also find us online on Instagram at Radio Free KJLH, or you can find me on my personal page at Dara Tucker B on Instagram. Everywhere else, you can find me at Dara Starr Tucker. That's Dara with one R and Star with two. I love being able to connect with you all online and having some deeper conversations about the topics that I discuss here on the air. And don't forget, if you happen to miss an episode of The Breakdown, you can always catch up with the episodes that you have missed online on the KJLH website at kjlhradio.com. I want to let you know how thrilled I am to be doing this particular episode this week. Last month, of course, we had Black History Month. This month is Women's History Month. And what I want to do for this episode is highlight three women that, for me, share a bit of a through line. There's a bit of a connection between these three female artists. I've done breakdowns on all of them, and I want to share those with you today. The breakdowns that I do often get into some important history on Black film and television and music. And for today's episode, I think I want to focus on music. I do a lot of breakdowns on music, and I want to particularly focus on the music of three really, really important women who were not only performers, not only writers and complete artists in their own right, but they were also activists. They are also activists. So I want to start with one very important historical figure, then I'll move to a figure that, in my estimation, kind of succeeded her in spirit and in tone, and then after that, I'm going to make the case for basically the third rung of this triumvirate of Black female artists that I think are all kind of intrinsically connected. And hopefully by the time you finish listening to these breakdowns on these three very important Black female artists, you'll understand why I have connected them all today during Women's History Month. It's a very interesting exercise to maybe consider these three women as being a part of a continuum, as being a part of a through line that connects them spiritually and musically and thematically. So I'm not going to reveal them all to you at the beginning. We're going to start with our first artist, who is Nina Simone. And maybe as you're listening to her story, it'll start to occur to you who these other two artists might be that I would connect to her. But I always love talking about Nina Simone because she was an unusual artist. Nina Simone is truly one of those artists that it is impossible to categorize. A lot of performers, a lot of writers and singers like to think of themselves as being beyond genre, but I think Nina Simone is truly one of the few artists that I would say is really without genre. She is uncategorizable. And I don't think she necessarily aspired to be that. I think that's just naturally what she was. There's nothing wrong with fitting in genre. There's nothing wrong with fitting into a particular category. Some of the most brilliant writers, performers, singers, musicians have a distinct genre, but Nina Simone did not. And that is part of her brilliance. So I'm going to start out Women's History Month honoring Nina Simone. We're going to take in this breakdown on her life, and then I'm going to come back and we're going to talk about artist number two that I feel really represents the natural succession to Nina Simone's legacy. But we'll start out with one of my favorite artists of all time, Miss Nina Simone. How did Eunice Kathleen Wayman, the sixth of eight children born in a poor family in Tryon, North Carolina, come to be one of the most sampled voices in hip-hop? And all I want is what I can buy now. I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. Eunice Wayman never intended to be a singer. In fact, it was really a consolation prize for what she really wanted to do, to play classical piano. She studied for a time at the famed Juilliard School of Music until she ran out of money. Her ultimate plan was to enroll in the Curtis Institute. When she didn't make it into the program, she was utterly devastated. She always felt there was a racial element to her being rejected by the admissions board, though it was nothing she could ever prove. For the rest of her life, she felt that on some levels she had failed to live up to her ideals for herself because of that rejection. After that, she started playing at a piano bar in Jersey, but since her mother, who was a strict Methodist minister, wouldn't have approved of her playing what she called the devil's music, she changed her name to Nina Simone to avoid being discovered. When the bar owner demanded that she sing as well as play, she reluctantly relented, even though she didn't think she had much of a voice. She started incorporating jazz, folk, blues, and the gospel she grew up with into her sets. This was the mid-1950s, so the folk scene was just beginning to take off. It didn't take long for Nina Simone to start drawing large crowds, and soon after, she secured an agent and a record deal. She ended up selling her rights to any future royalties on her 1959 debut album, Little Girl Blue, which contained some of her biggest hits. She was paid just $3,000 for that album and never earned anything more for songs like I Loves You Porgy, Love Me or Leave Me, and My Baby Just Cares for Me. She married a terribly abusive man in 1961 named Andy Shroud, who would act as her manager for the next 10 years, and they had a daughter that they named Simone. Two events in 1963 marked a major change in Nina's message and in the trajectory of her career. The murder of civil rights leader Medgar Evers and the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, that killed four young Black girls. Her most controversial song, Mississippi Goddam, was boycotted by radio stations all over the South. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam. She performed at civil rights marches and supported Black nationalism. She even advocated violent revolution if necessary. This philosophy came to mirror her home life, which was becoming increasingly volatile. As her husband continued to abuse her, she was known to turn her fits of anger and rage onto her daughter, Simone. What no one knew for years is that Nina was dealing with undiagnosed and untreated bipolar disorder, a condition which she would battle for the rest of her life. Nina Simone helped to provide the soundtrack to the civil rights movement, so it's no wonder that artists like Kanye West, Jay-Z, and Lil Wayne have all found inspiration in her music. There's a depth and a richness to her music and message that defies genre categorization. Nina Simone is the embodiment of fearless artistry and represents at the highest level the transcendent beauty of Black American music. Miss Nina Simone, she had such a complex life. She was such a complex character. There was so much hardship, so much pain, and so much brilliance in her life and in her career. And she laid the groundwork for so many. She's one of the few artists that I think did not get her just due in her day, but has become more popular as time has gone on. I feel like it's taken a while for the times to catch up with Nina Simone. And as I think we've all noticed in the last 20 to 30 years, Nina Simone has become cool in a way that she really never was during her lifetime. There certainly were those who appreciated her and who she was and what she had to offer. But in this era of protests and of speaking out and of social justice warriors on all fronts, who Nina Simone was and what she represents to the culture is becoming more and more relevant as time goes on. It's just taken time for the culture to catch up with her. I still don't feel that Nina Simone has gotten her just due. She's often called the High Priestess of Soul, but I think that title is even too small for her. I think the assignation of her being a soul artist is just not big enough for her, but she was the High Priestess. All hail the High Priestess, Miss Nina Simone. Now let's take a look at our second artist. She was absolutely not a carbon copy of Nina. She very much had her own way of expressing herself. She left her own indelible mark that was hers and hers alone, but there was a lot in the spirit of who she was and what she did that continued the legacy of Nina Simone. And that artist is Miss Roberta Flack. She was a pianist, she was a writer, she was a singer, she was an activist, but she was also known for interpreting and covering other people's music brilliantly. So I want to play the breakdown that I did for you of the song that launched Roberta Flack's career. And I talk a bit in this breakdown about the connection that I have always seen and felt between Nina Simone and Roberta Flack. If you've never thought of them as being connected in that way, then maybe it'll make a little more sense after you listen to this breakdown. So here it is, the breakdown on Roberta Flack's The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. When you hear this line, the first time, you know you might as well go make yourself a sandwich because you're going to be here a while. When I was a kid, I thought this song was depressing and interminable. I've since grown to love it, but it's been a journey. The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face was originally popularized by the legendary Roberta Flack, and by this point, it's ubiquitous. It's been sung on reality shows, it's been belted, numerous notable singers have covered it. The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face launched Roberta Flack into superstardom in the early 70s. But what many people may not know is that the version that we all know and love is itself a cover song, and if Dirty Harry, of all people, hadn't intervened,
well, do you, punk?
We might never have heard it at all. I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. Roberta Flack occupies an interesting territory on the musical landscape. Many people think of her as a singer-songwriter, and while she is a very prolific songwriter, most of the songs that she's known for singing were actually covers by other singer-songwriters, like Eugene McDaniels, who wrote two of Roberta's biggest hits, compared to what?
Trying to make it real.
And Feel Like Making Love. You could almost think of Roberta Flack as the natural successor to Nina Simone's legacy. Both Nina and Roberta's primary strength lay in their ability to completely reimagine a song and make it their own. Roberta's rise really began just as Nina Simone left the U.S. to seek refuge in Liberia. Nina and Roberta were both born in North Carolina. Both were childhood prodigies, showing promise on the piano at an early age. Both grew up heavily steeped in church music, but had extensive training in classical music. They both even described missing out on early career opportunities due to racism.
But I didn't understand why I didn't get that scholarship, and there were people around me who knew about my talent as well, and they said, Nina, it's because you are black.
I should have won, but I didn't. And one of the reasons I didn't win was because it was a segregated contest.
They were both known for producing socially conscious music and both had a reputation for being a bit difficult to work with. And ultimately, they were both equally difficult to categorize musically.
Roberta was a genius, and they never knew what to do with her.
Roberta Flack was born in Black Mountain, North Carolina, but was mostly raised in Arlington, Virginia. She received a full classical piano scholarship to Howard University at the age of 15. She eventually became a music teacher in D.C. In the late 60s, she started performing at a local club called Mr. Henry's on Capitol Hill. Her soulful balladry began to create a buzz, and she quickly became a local sensation. Jazz pianist and singer Les McCann stopped by Mr. Henry's to see what the fuss was all about, and he was entranced.
I saw what appeared to be this very timid person. Just shy and reserved, but underneath I knew there was a strong, powerful person because of the way she sang.
He immediately called Joel Dorn, a producer with Atlantic Records, and urged him to sign her.
It was Les McCann called here. He said, there's a girl in Washington. Her name is Roberta Flack. I said, I heard about Roberta Flack before. Leave me alone. I don't want any chick singers. They're a problem. They're a hassle. Les McCann didn't want to know about no for an answer. So I said, fine, I'll send her a contract. And then, you know, then I heard the tape, and then I heard her. It was unbelievable.
We went in, I recorded 40 songs.
the 10 or 11 songs that are on that album were from that session. And they call that album First Take because I did them like in one take.
The second song on the B-side was an interpretation of a song called The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. It was written by a British folk singer in 1957 named Ewan McCall, who was known for writing mostly protest and labor songs. He wrote it for the woman he was having an affair with, singer Peggy Seeger, who would later become his wife. She's the half-sister of legendary folk singer Pete Seeger. Now, if you've never heard the original, brace yourself. It's nothing like the version most of us know and love.
The first time.
And it strangely didn't become a hit at the time. After McCall and Seeger released the original version, the song was covered mostly in folk circles, having been recorded by people like Gordon Lightfoot.
The first time ever I saw your face.
Peter, Paul, and Mary.
I thought the sun rose in your eyes.
And the Kingston Trio. Roberta Flack first heard the song from a gospel folk duo called Joe and Eddie around 1965. She performed it frequently at Mr. Henry's. The song appeared on Roberta's debut project in 1969, but it really didn't garner much attention. It was played on the radio here and there, but it wasn't released as a single and it didn't make much of a splash. Enter Dirty Harry.
Do you bunk?
Well, he wasn't Dirty Harry quite yet. Clint Eastwood had played in mostly westerns throughout the 1960s. He helped popularize the so-called spaghetti western genre, but he still hadn't garnered much acclaim. He longed for a sense of creative control, and he knew he could only find that through directing. He finally got his chance with 1971's Play Misty for Me. It was the story of a jazz DJ who ends up being stalked by a crazed listener. Clint Eastwood wanted to find the perfect song to accompany a love scene between his character Dave and the Donna Mills character Toby.
The story is that he was driving down the Los Angeles freeway and heard the song.
The first time ever I lay with you.
He said the song just totally hypnotized him.
And he found himself driving off the side of the freeway.
He immediately called both Roberta Flack and producer Joel Dorn to get permission to use the song.
Clint Eastwood's on the phone. He said, I just finished directing my first film. It's called Play Misty for Me. And he said, I want to use that song in the montage that the whole movie builds to. So I said, knock yourself out, Jack.
Roberta tried to convince Clint to let her go into the studio and record a truncated version of the song.
And we talked, and he said he wanted to use it, and I said, no. And I said, it's too long. I'd like to, you know, to do it again. He said, no, I'd like to use it. So I said, well, take the first 8 or 16 bars out. You don't need that piano intro. He said, I want every note.
He used the entire song in the film. The Roberta Flack version is such an affecting interpretation, mostly due to the fact that it's significantly slower than the original. Turns out that interminable quality is exactly what makes it so special. It forces the listener to concentrate on each and every word. This was a creative choice Roberta made against the advice of producer Joel Dorn. He told her that it would ruin any chance the song had of becoming a commercial success. And for a time, he was right. The song was released in 1969, and it just sort of sat there. Only when Clint Eastwood decided to include it on the soundtrack of Play Misty for Me in 1971 did it make a splash.
I felt the earth moving my hand.
The song was out there, it had been out there, and every now and then you'd hear it on the radio, but it did not have the wide acceptance until people could associate something visual with it.
After that, Atlantic Records released the song as a single, trimmed by 1 minute. Suddenly, it was being played everywhere, and Roberta's career was launched into the stratosphere.
If that hadn't happened, she might have spent her life singing at Mr. Henry's. And the world kicked the doors down.
In early 1972, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face reached number 1 on Billboard's Hot 100 and Easy Listening charts. It reached number 4 on the R&B chart. And at the 1972 Grammy Awards, it won both Record of the Year and Song of the Year.
The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
Roberta Flack.
And that sold 4 million records and won a Grammy for Record of the Year. It skyrocketed her.
It's a very exciting occasion for me. If I could stand here and thank a million people, I'd like to thank everybody. Thank you very much.
And in what was possibly the coolest honor, NASA chose The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face as the wake-up music on the last day of the final lunar mission before the astronauts of Apollo 17 returned to Earth in 1972. A fitting way to capture the wonder of laying eyes on the face of the moon one last time. So Nina Simone, Roberta Flack, two women who made an indelible mark on music, who stood their ground, who insisted on being exactly who they were in the industry. I would say that Roberta Flack definitely saw a lot more pop success than Nina Simone did, and she's definitely someone whose music was able to cross over in a way that Nina Simone's never was. But I think she represented that next logical progression as being a Black female musician who also wrote and who really came here with something to say from day one. The fact that Nina Simone had already happened and Roberta Flack came along really in the 70s meant that Roberta's career would move along a different trajectory than Nina Simone's did, of course. Which brings me to the third artist that I want to highlight this Women's History Month. And she is a singer and songwriter that has been so impactful for people of my generation who really came of age in the 1990s and the early 2000s. When you talk about coming here with something to say, I mean from the very start of the very first album, right out of the gate, we knew that she was going to be different from anything else that had come along before. I'm talking about the one and only Miss India Arie. She's a singer, she's a prolific songwriter, she is a musician, she is a 360 artist in the same way that a Roberta Flack or a Nina Simone would have been. And if you're paying attention to what she has to say off the stage, then you know she is not afraid to speak her mind, much like Roberta and much like Nina. And yes, it has gotten her in hot water from time to time, just like it did with Roberta and just like it did with Nina. But we also look to her to light the way in terms of activism, just like we did with Roberta Flack and just like we did with Nina Simone. And India's path has been her own. She is artistically unique, but the spirit of who she is and what she represents is very much in line with artists like Roberta Flack and with Nina. So that's the reason I choose to include her in this grouping and why I would say she is a part of this continuum of outspoken, well-informed, artistically rich, and socially relevant Black female artists. She is an original, just like Nina and just like Roberta. And she really has given that tip of the hat, that nod to those who came before her, really with the first verse of the very first song that she ever put out. So I'm going to play for you now a breakdown that I did in honor of my favorite India Arie album, which was her sophomore project called Voyage to India. Here it is. For those of us who came of age in the late 90s and early 2000s, Black music was in a really interesting place by the turn of the century. The golden era of R&B in the 90s was slowly dying off. The so-called neo-soul movement that had happened in the mid to late 90s with artists like D'Angelo, Erykah Badu, Maxwell, and Jill Scott had already made an indelible mark on the culture. Then the 2000s came along, and we were all wondering where the music would go. So when an artist named India Arie came along in 2001 with her debut album, Acoustic Soul, we knew we were hearing something that was unlike anything that had come before it. I'm Dara Starr Tucker, and this is The Breakdown. India Arie has always been an industry anomaly. From her chosen instrument, to her eclectic style, to her message, it's safe to say an artist like her would not be likely to break through in the current pop market. But she burst onto the scene in 2001 with a song called Video, which has become an anthem of female empowerment. "I'm not the average girl from your video," she warned us, and she meant it. Nothing she's done since then has been conventional. The thing that really distinguished India Arie in the marketplace was her message of empowerment and self-love. Though her debut album did contain songs like Brown Skin and Ready for Love that spoke of romantic relationships, the majority of her music focused on the connection between human beings and our connection with ourselves and with spirit. This was an artist that people could listen to while they drove their children to school. But one of the things that doesn't get enough attention is how revolutionary it was to see a Black artist playing the guitar. Outside of Bill Withers, it was almost unheard of before then. If you did see a Black artist like Richie Havens, Tracy Chapman, or Cassandra Wilson playing guitar, they probably weren't singing R&B or soul. It just wasn't done. But that all changed when India Arie hit the scene. Suddenly, it was cool for sensitive Black kids to sit on their beds and write about their feelings. When you think about it, it's a permission that they really had not been granted by the culture before that, and it represented a sea change in Black music. If you see a Black person under the age of 40 playing guitar, you can probably thank India Arie. Acoustic Soul was would go on to become a bona fide pop soul classic. Although that project received 7 Grammy nominations, she was completely shut out that year. There was much hullabaloo made about why that may have been. Many saw it as a repudiation of who she was and what she represented, considering that she did not fit within many industry norms. But in 2002, 20 years ago this year, she cemented her place in music history with a masterpiece called Voyage to India, named after a track from Stevie Wonder's Secret Life of Plants. Voyage to India was a 15-track ode to self-acceptance that defied any notions of a sophomore slump. It's one of those projects where you read the track listing and you think, there's no way all this gold was contained on a single album. Little Things, Slow Down, The Truth, Get It Together, Headed in the Right Direction. There really are no skip tracks here. The album was certified platinum, and at the 2003 Grammy Awards, it won Best R&B Album, and Little Things won Best Urban Alternative Performance. Not a lot of folks knew it, though, because their awards were not given out on the air that year. So Voyage to India would have to represent a quiet victory in that respect. NDRE has gone on to record 6 more albums, bursting with healing and light. She occupies a unique territory on the musical landscape, expertly blending soul and spirit to express equal amounts of searching and self-assurance. Whether she's always gotten her just due within the industry is debatable. But for those of us on whom her music and spirit have left an indelible mark, her influence and impact are undeniable.
So Nina Simone, Roberta Flack, NDRE, 3 inspiring, genuine, soulful artists in honor of Women's History Month. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Breakdown and the opportunity to contemplate the music, the beauty, the joy, and the artistry of these 3 incredible women. And what I want to know from you is, what artists would you add to this lineage? Who are some other singer-songwriter activists that you feel belong in this grouping? Who is a female singer-songwriter activist that is breaking onto the scene now?